Thanks for downloading the World Tonight podcast for Thursday, the 21st of November. I'm Jane Hill. The International Criminal Court has issued arrest warrants for Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, along with its former defence minister and the military commander of Hamas. The court said the three were responsible for war crimes. We'll have reaction from a former Israeli prime minister and hear the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. Failure is not an option, the UN Secretary-General told the COP29 climate summit today. It's meant to end on Friday. Will it? And is much going to be achieved? And a musical treat as we dip into some previously unheard recordings of Miles Davis in 1960s Paris. Israel called it a dark day for justice as the International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the former Defence Minister Yoav Gallant, along with the military commander of Hamas, Mohammed Deif. Judges at the court in The Hague said there were reasonable grounds that the three men bore criminal responsibility for alleged war crimes during the war between Israel and Hamas. While speaking this evening, Mr. Netanyahu condemned the move.
This is an anti-Semitic step that has one goal, to deter me, to deter us, from exercising our natural right to defend ourselves against enemies who are rising up against us to destroy us. The state of Israel is accused of genocide, while we are working to defend ourselves from an enemy who is trying to commit genocide against us. We are accused of deliberately harming civilians, while we are doing everything to prevent harm to civilians.
People in Tel Aviv gave their reaction to the court's announcement.
First of all, we're not going to let you guys have your hands on him. Not going to happen. And second, wait a couple of months till Trump gets on board, and then we'll see what you have to say.
Because Hague is an anti-Semitic court in an anti-Semitic world, and they just hate Netanyahu because he's the greatest leader in the world now. And Trump.
So I don't know on what basis they decided to issue the warrants. Maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. I don't care if they arrest Bibi Netanyahu. As far as I'm concerned, he can sit in jail for the rest of his life.
Well, the ICC has been part of the global justice system since 2002. The UK is a member, and we'll explore the choices facing the government here in a few moments. But the US and Israel are not members. Let's speak first tonight, then, to Ehud Olmert, who was Israel's Prime Minister from 2006 to 2009. A very good evening to you. Thank you for joining us on The World Tonight. Your response to this ruling from the court today?
I must say that I was utterly surprised because I genuinely believe that no Israeli government and no Israeli military commander, Minister of Defense, of course not the Prime Minister, ever gave any command to the Israeli military forces that they could shoot indiscriminately against civilians in Gaza. It is well known that the Hamas fighters were embedded inside the most densely populated areas in Gaza, which is one of the most crowded places on the earth. And therefore, there was an immediate and imminent danger to many innocent people. But there was no policy, no purpose, no objective to kill innocent people. And therefore, I think that to the degree that I'm absolutely against the Israeli government, I don't trust them on a lot of things. This, I think, is entirely out of context.
But what the court is saying isn't only about firing and military activities. It's about starvation, for example. Tens of thousands of people without food, without water, without medicine.
I know. I'm not familiar with every detail of the charges which were put against the Prime Minister and the Minister of Defense. I know that we were supporting the supply of humanitarian needs of the population. In many occasions, he was confiscated and taken by the Hamas people and deprived the population from receiving what they need to receive. So I guess that there was a problem. We are making all kinds of efforts in order to allow the humanitarian supplies to come in. And again, I think that there has never been any policy of Israel to deprive the population from the humanitarian needs. And I think that this is really grossly exaggerated It's something that while a majority of the Israelis don't trust the prime minister for good reasons, not because of what he did to the Palestinians or what he did in Gaza, but what he does inside Israel to the Israeli people. Had someone suggested that the Israeli police would arrest Netanyahu for his reckless operations as prime minister that is shaking the foundations of the country inside the state of Israel, I guess that the reaction within Israel would have been entirely different. But when it comes to this, a majority of the Israelis would feel very much that this is not realistic. It's not something that we can support.
Okay. Do you expect member countries of the ICC to comply with this?
I hope not, honestly. I hope not. Again, as far as I'm concerned, Netanyahu has to be fired today. He is not qualified. He does not deserve to be prime minister of the state of Israel. He failed. He was utterly responsible for the failure of Israel to anticipate the attack of Hamas on the 7th of October. And then the way it was handled since then is outrageously a great failure that should have been criticized and is criticized. And the fact that it doesn't stop the war now and that he risks the life of 101 Israeli hostages is obnoxious and something that can't be tolerated and can't be accepted. But Israel has not committed a genocide or war crimes that deserve these charges against the Prime Minister and the Minister of Defense. Everything that needs to be done in order to get rid of Netanyahu because of what he does inside Israel is something that is incumbent upon the Israelis, and we will try to do it.
Ehud Olmert, thank you so much for your time here tonight. Thank you, Prime Minister of Israel from 2006 to 2009. Well, 124 member states are obliged under this to arrest and hand over anyone who is subject to an ICC arrest warrant if they set foot on their territory. As we've said, Israel and the US are not members, but all EU countries are, for example, as is the UK. The last time Benjamin Netanyahu visited the UK, about 18 months ago, there were protests outside Downing Street. So what might happen if he comes here again? The Labour MP, Emily Thornberry, is chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. Good evening.
Good evening.
If he does come to the UK again, will he be arrested?
Well, we're signatories to the Rome Agreement, and it's pretty clear on that what our obligations would be. We support the International Criminal Court. It's an independent court. If it has decided that there is a case for him to answer and that warrants should be issued, then as signatories, we ought to be arresting him, yeah.
So you're quite clear on that, because what came out of Downing Street earlier was not as clear. It talked about recognising the independence of the court, but it wouldn't go much further than that.
Well, it didn't want to speculate on whether or not he would arrive, and they didn't want to be asked hypothetical questions. And but I'm just saying that, you know, it's kind of clear that given that we have signed up to the ICC, we have obligations as a result of that. And that is that if someone with a warrant outstanding from the ICC comes into your jurisdiction, then you have to arrest them.
I hope you could hear Ehud Olmert just before you. Do you have any difficulty here with the fact that these warrants draw, as many are pointing out, a moral equivalence between Israel, a democracy, and Hamas, a terrorist organisation?
I think that it's approaching it from the wrong angle. I think what you do is you need to look at what does international law say, and it applies to everybody equally. You can't say, oh, I'm a democracy, therefore the law doesn't apply to me in the same way. I mean, it applies to everyone equally or it doesn't apply at all. And that's the point. And so, you know, if there is a case for people to answer, and three judges, independent judges, have decided that there is a case to answer, then a warrant is issued and it should be done without fear or favour.
Adil Haq, who's a professor of law at Rutgers University in the US, has told Newsnight that these warrants mean there's potential legal jeopardy for any governments that supply Israel with weapons. Is that going to be an issue here? I mean, David Lammy did announce the suspension of 30 arms licenses to Israel in September, but do you think that's going to become an issue and that the government should consider suspending more?
I mean, this is not my area of expertise, but I think it would be a stretch. The British government have made decisions about which weapons we will sell to Israel. And essentially it's this, that weapons are not to be sold to Israel unless they are defensive. Weapons are not to be sold to Israel if there is a possibility that they would be used for internal repression or external aggression. That's the basis upon which the government has made the decisions that it has on the legal advice that it's had. So actually, you know, it's the weapons are simply being sold for self-defense and only self-defense, is my understanding.
Okay. Well, while you're with us, Emily Thornberry, if I may, in a moment, we're going to talk more about what President Putin has been saying in the last few hours. You're aware, I'm sure, we're going to hear from our Russia editor in a moment. But listeners will have heard in the news bulletin, President Putin, really very strong language, very strong words tonight, making a direct warning to Britain and others not to fire targets on Russian soil, all in relation to the war in Ukraine. I'm just interested in your reaction to that, if I may, as you're with us.
Sure. Well, we won't be firing weapons on the Russians. What we do is we supply the Ukrainians, and the Ukrainians are fighting the war, and the Ukrainians are fighting the war, frankly, on behalf of the West, because the last thing we want is an empowered Putin sitting in Kyiv, thinking that looking around and looking to see what he's going to do next. It's very important that the Ukrainians win this war, and they have been subjected to the most terrible bombing campaign. And what they want to do is they want to be able to use some of the weapons that we've supplied them to be able to fire into those installations that are being used within Russia, that are being used to send bombs into Ukraine. So as a preemptive strike, almost. That's what the issue is. And it looks like our weapons are now being used for that. We've had threats from Putin before throughout this war. I think that it's just very important that we stand with Ukraine and that we stand solid and we remain united. And we have done until now. And I hope that we remain so, because without our support, Ukraine could be defeated.
Emily Thornberry, for now, thanks very much, Chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. So, as I say, let's stay with that. Let's talk to our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, because, Steve, very strong words from Vladimir Putin, a direct warning, really. He said Moscow had the right to use its weapons against the military installations on any country that had supplied them or helped Ukraine. Just to tell us more about the context and your take, crucially, on the language here.
Yeah, that was the bit that stood out for me, actually. I mean, basically, I think what he was doing was setting out this big red line and saying to the West, look, this is the red line. I know you've crossed red lines in the past and I've done nothing, but this is my red line now. And take me seriously, because I'm not bluffing. You know, over the last few months, he had given signals and messages, call them what you will, to the West, that if America or Europe removes the restrictions on the use of their long-range missiles and allows Ukraine to target Russian soil, that will be a red line. That will be crossing a red line for Putin. And he will view that as the direct participation of NATO countries in the war in Ukraine. He said it in June. He said it again in September, in October. This week, he lowered the nuclear threshold, another unsubtle hint. And today we have this his first comments about the use of these weapons on Russian soil in this very dramatic TV address, basically saying, well, the what was a regional conflict in Ukraine has now acquired a sort of global nature, and telling the world that Russia had fired this new sort of experimental weapon, this hypersonic intermediate-range ballistic missile, at a target in Ukraine, in Dnipro, this missile called Oreshnik, and then saying that he believes that his country has the right to use its weapons against military sites in those countries that give their weapons to other countries, which are then used against Russia. In other words, he's talking about Ukraine and the support it's getting from America and Europe.
Steve, as ever, thanks so much. Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor, of course. Now, just another pointer as to what's coming up a little later on the programme. The newly uncovered recordings of Miles Davis in Paris that shed fresh light on the jazz legend's career.
Miles Davis, just like other black men at that time, they felt at home when they went to Paris. Europe and Paris in particular became a panacea for people like Miles Davis and others.
Coming up a little later. Now, the tributes to John Prescott have poured in from people of all political convictions today. Britain's longest-serving Deputy Prime Minister, who's died at the age of 86. Many of those tributes mention his big personality, that punch during an election campaign, and his working-class roots. He was a bridge between old and new Labour, ushered in by Tony Blair in 1997. Speaking on Desert Island Discs on Radio 4, Lord Prescott said he was dogged by feeling inferior throughout his life.
All the attacks on me because of my grammar and kind of background, aggressive style, it used to rough up a few feathers. And whilst I never let it show, it was certainly deeply inside me. I felt a bit inferior in it. You do feel it, and it's still there. And then you're attacked by public schoolboys, many of them in the Tory party, some in Labour, and they have a go about you because of the language when they've had such a privileged education. That makes it, in a way, I react in a class way. It's a class war then, and that is part of me.
John Prescott. So is it still a big deal to be working class in British politics? And how much does it matter to voters? Let's discuss with the Labour MP Natalie Fleet, who was elected earlier this year. She represents Bolsover. And Aaron Reeves, who is Professor of Sociology at LSE, the London School of Economics. He's written a book, Born to Rule, The Making and Remaking of the British Elite. Evening to both of you.
Hello.
Evening.
Natalie, I mean, you agreed to come on the programme because you say you're working class, you identify as that. How do you define it? What does it mean to you?
For me, it's about who you are and where you come from. So a lot of people say that I'm not working class because I used to work in an office, or that I earn too much to be working class now. But like John Prescott just said, it's about the way you feel, and you absolutely do not feel at home in a palace. You feel terrified every day. John Prescott spoke to me at conference back in 2012. I spoke and he said to me afterwards, "Were you nervous?" And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "That'll never go away." And I just knew then that there was an acceptance that to be working class is about life experience that you bring to Parliament. It's about values that you hold. It's about looking after each other and having that sense of community. It's never about salary. It's about the things you eat and the places you go on holiday. It's about every part of you. And it doesn't just disappear. And when you do feel absolutely terrified in a palace and you feel like you shouldn't be there, and there are other people, members of the public and members of the political class, usually the other party, because my colleagues, there's a lot of us that are working class, which I absolutely love. When they feel like you shouldn't be there, I look to people like John Prescott and think I should. And I also see what he delivered, because nobody else is going to fight for the working class like people like he did and like the working class MPs now will do.
I mean, this is fascinating. There's so much to talk to you. Let's just bring in Professor Reeves, though, Aaron Reeves, because it's interesting there that Natalie says, actually, in her party, there's lots of working class people now. You've actually looked at the stats and the data on all of this, and to what extent is it shifting over time, the makeup of Parliament?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, this is a very working class government that we have at the moment, in particular a very working class cabinet, perhaps the most working class in terms of origins that we've had. Certainly the Labour Party have had more working class MPs in the past, but not necessarily in government. But I think there's two issues here that kind of need to be passed and pulled apart a little bit. And I think what Natalie's saying is exactly right, that you know, being working class often is about a sense of solidarity with people that you grew up with. It's about where you come from. But there's also another sense in which working class is about the jobs that you've done during your life. And I think that that has changed somewhat in terms of the makeup of members of parliament in particular and Labour Party members. It used to be the case that many more of them had done working class jobs during their working lives and then become MPs. And it's become more common, I think, now to have had working class origins and roots, but then have maybe done more middle class jobs through their careers before becoming MPs. And I think that has an influence on the kinds of commitments and solidarities that you have. And as Natalie talks about, the kinds of who you're going to try and serve and work for when you get into office.
Yes. Has it? I mean, do you feel even on a daily basis, Natalie, it affects you, it impacts you? You tell me what the difference is.
Yeah, it does absolutely impact me every day. I just feel like the institution is designed to intimidate and rule people like me rather than have people like me in it. But we have got the most ever working class government, which I'm really proud to be on those benches behind them. It's fantastic. Just picking up what Aaron was saying on jobs that you've done in your life that are less likely to be working class, what really knocks me is that I feel like I absolutely feel part of the working class. And when I was younger, I came from a very working class mining family. But my mum was a single parent. I was a parent at 15. I had a really difficult childhood and absolutely strived to be working class. And via my education, I worked really hard and I feel like I did become working class. But people look at my husband, he's a plumber, and traditionally men's jobs, we still class them as working class. Because I went to work in an office, then it's like, oh, well, not as many women as are as working class. I don't think the data reflects class as well as it could.
And Aaron Reeves, is it fair to say that we also see increasingly politicians now keen to talk up any working class roots that they have, as however we're going to perceive that, but actually it's now something that people want to trumpet, you know, my father is a toolmaker and all of that sort of thing?
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, one of the big trends that we document in the book that we've written, Born to Rule, as you mentioned, is that there is this desire, this struggle to come across as being kind of ordinary, regular, or working class. And that comes through in a variety of different ways that MPs are maybe downplaying in some ways, or even perhaps obscuring some of the advantages that they may have had in their lives. And that may have scaffolded their ability to get into these positions. Sometimes they do that by deflecting privilege by talking about maybe grandparents that maybe came from working class backgrounds, skipping over perhaps the more middle class parents that they have had themselves. And so one of the reasons that seems to be true is because the general public also seem to value people who have got into these sorts of positions if they've come from the kinds of backgrounds that Natalie has. That seems to be something in many ways that people value, because it seems that people have got their, you know, defying the odds and kind of working against those kinds of difficulties that people regularly admit face people from working class backgrounds at getting into these kinds of positions. So I do think it is something that people are trying to play up, particularly politicians who have a very public mandate and who operate in that. But actually, it cuts across a number of different fields that we were able to document this kind of orientation and trend.
And Natalie, a quick thought. You've articulated so well how tricky it can be inside Parliament, but has it really helped you in terms of the actual people you represent and cutting through to them?
So when I was trying to be elected, I knocked on their doors and they said to me, it's not about you, Duck. You're all the same. We're not interested in any of you. Could have a very quick conversation with them and I could say, no, we're not. And I want to change that too. I want to be one of those people that goes down to Parliament from our community and represents us in London. And I will be your representative there. There are people who try to say they're working class politically, and people see through that straight away. They see that there is the most working class government in front of them, and that's really key to rebuilding trust.
Really good to talk to both of you. Thank you so much. Natalie Fleet, Labour MP for Bolsover, and Professor Aaron Reeves from the LSE. Thank you. Now, failure is not an option, the UN Secretary General told the COP29 climate summit in Azerbaijan today. The gathering is due to end tomorrow, and with just a matter of hours to go, many participating countries wouldn't disagree with Antonio Guterres that substantive differences remain. The main priority is to agree a new target to replace the $100 billion a year that rich nations provide to poorer ones to help them reduce emissions and adapt to disasters. Our climate editor, Justin Rowland, that is in Baku. He told me where the negotiations are.
You could easily say it's all to play for. The new draft text for the potential agreement arrived at 8 a.m. this morning. The key one is the deal on finance, agreeing how much cash rich countries should pay to poor countries to tackle climate change is the main issue here in Azerbaijan. And if you want a measure of the difficulties this summit has faced, Jane, the size of that document is it. It started out, right at the beginning, when the conference opened on Monday, it was 9 pages long. It then ballooned to almost 40 pages as countries poured in amendments. Now it's back down to 10 pages. So that's how much progress we've made. What we've got in that document is a series of options, some empty spaces where numbers, the amount of money should be. And what we've been hearing here is howls of anger from climate vulnerable smaller nations demanding a generous settlement from industrialized countries.
Yes. And when I read some of the comments and things that have been said in the hall, I mean, some of it sounded quite heated, quite bad tempered, really.
It is bad tempered. I mean, this is a negotiation, right? So people are laying out their kind of position publicly. Behind the scenes, there's a kind of much calmer discussion. People understand this process. A lot of the negotiators have been around for ages. It's like a high stakes game of poker for the future of the planet, if you like. Two numbers are crucial here. What people want to know is how much hard cash, how much kind of real money, if you like, will developed countries make. At the moment, it's about 100 billion. Half of it is hard cash. The rest of that 100 billion is solid loans and stuff provided by developed nations. So that's what they pay at the moment, 100 billion. So that's called the core finance. That's the middle of the deal. And that core finance probably will end up something like 200, maybe 300 billion. When that's due is still to be agreed, but it looks like it's probably going to land about 2035. So we've got 10 years to ramp up from 100 billion to perhaps say 250 billion. And then there's going to be another figure, and it's a kind of more aspirational figure for the total finance owing. When you hear people say, you know, we need $1 trillion a year, that's the aspirational figure. That will include much more cash from other places, from the multinational development banks. We think that'll scale up by another couple of hundred billion. And then there's going to be money from private finance. And the figure there we're thinking is probably going to settle around $1 trillion. Because I can say at this point, before the deal's done, with a kind of sounding quite confident, I think should communicate to you, Jane, that we kind of know where this is going to land. And there's another whole area of debate, and that's about the language used about transitioning away from fossil fuels, about cutting carbon emissions, which is at the heart of this. And there's been a battle where kind of the oil-rich countries led by Saudi Arabia have been pushing back at the idea that we should include language saying transitioning away from fossil fuel, which was, of course, agreed in Dubai last year. So a big battle over that. But these negotiations are always fraught at this stage. They almost always overrun. I haven't been to as many as some of my colleagues. One of my colleagues was saying they think there's only one that's actually finished on time. So, you know, we're 20... in the 29th COP. So look, we're always at deadlock, you know, at the point, you know, you're in the haggle, if you like, you're in the carpet stall in Baku and you're haggling over the carpet, you know, it always gets intense just before the deal is done. I think that would be what people would say.
The BBC's Justin Rowlatt, and also in Baku is Todd Stern, who was special envoy for climate change under President Obama. He led the US effort in negotiating the Paris Agreement. He gave me his assessment of the summit and whether a deal will be agreed.
You know, Jane, it's not what you would want, but have I seen it like this? Yeah, definitely. I think it's not clear, but if you're asking me to bet one way or another, I bet that it'll get done. You know, countries like not to have the thing kind of seize up and fail to come to an ending. And that, I mean, that has happened, but it's not what countries want.
So your optimism that there may be a deal within the next day or two, how useful is that when we are only a couple of months away from a new president in the White House and we know what his take is on climate change generally, and he's made specific comments about pulling out of the Paris Agreement that you were so involved in?
It's still very important. Countries have been through this before, unfortunately. It happened in 2017. And the important thing there was that countries kept soldiering on and actually making some important progress during that time period. And obviously, Trump is going to come in. I think he will take us out of the Paris Agreement again. But it is nonetheless quite important to do the things that are the focus of COP this year. And you know, one of the things I always talk about when I talk to other countries is that the national level for the U.S. will kind of go quiet on climate, but there's a whole hell of a lot of stuff that is going on in the U.S. Thanks actually to the Biden administration, there was, you know, their famous IRA legislation, which has led to literally hundreds of billions of dollars of clean energy investment all over the country and very smartly heavily installed in Republican states, so-called red states, which means that those states, whether they're for Trump or not, don't want any of that stuff to go away. They want that to keep coming because it's creating jobs, it's putting in new factories, it's doing all sorts of things that are very good. So there's going to be a lot of action that is going to keep moving in the United States at a high clip.
IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act. So that's interesting. You're exactly saying it shifts from the national level to the state level, and we've seen that happen before. But does it not mean that the US will then still not be seen on the global stage as a leader in this, as being able to offer any leadership?
Yes. I mean, on the global stage, that is absolutely right. It's obviously damaging at the level of that you are missing one of the biggest players in the world. And it's not the case that, you know, for anything big and important, you absolutely have to have the United States, but it sure is helpful if you have the United States. And it has an impact in connection with the U.S.-China relationship, because if President Xi Jinping knows he can go for 4 years and the U.S. president, when he meets with him, is never going to say the words climate change, that's one thing. If, as was the case when President Obama was president, Xi Jinping knew that every time he met with the president, he was going to talk about climate change and push China. You know, that you have two different kinds of realities.
I mean, would you still consider yourself an optimist on the topic of climate change? I mean, there would be those who say even Paris hasn't really would. What do you say to those people?
For starters, I would say that, you know, people used to ask me all the time when I was leading the U.S. team, you know, am I an optimist or a pessimist? And I would always say I'm not either one. I'm right in the middle. I mean, I think we can do what we need to do, and it's always hard. But I also think that we can get done what we need to get done. So in that sense, yeah, I'm somewhat optimistic, but I'm also realistic. And we're moving in the right direction. I mean, that is absolutely true. But there are still lots of hurdles, and we are not yet reducing emissions enough. And we're going in the right direction, but not fast enough. And the reality with climate change is we're in a race against time, so speed matters.
Todd Stern there in Baku, former US climate envoy. Now, a real treat, I hope you'll agree, because some never-heard-before recordings of the Miles Davis Quintet are released this month. The American trumpeter, widely considered one of the greatest jazz musicians of all time, of course, lived and worked in Paris in the 1960s. And the new release includes tracks recorded with his band during this hugely important time in his career. I've been talking to the music journalist Marcus J. Moore from his home in New York. He's written the cover notes for the box set Miles in France, Miles Davis Quintet, 1963 and 64.
The first iteration of the quintet, they had all been working together for a few years. But the second great quintet is the one that pretty much defined Miles Davis's future. So, you know, when you listen to the first half of the box set, you're going to hear music that sounds a little more traditional than the second half of the box set. The experimentation that happens on the second half is because of the musicians that are all pushing themselves towards a certain kind of future. And that's Wayne Shorter, Herbie Hancock, Ron Carter, and Tony Williams, with Miles Davis heading the band. So listen to the song So What? Because if you know that song, you know it from the Kind of Blue album, and you know that it's a romantic ballad. But when you listen to the different iterations of So What throughout this box set, you hear it quickened to a pace that, quite frankly, I wasn't expecting, and it almost sounds like a totally different song.
And the second quintet. Was that Miles Davis pulling all these guys together because he just had a sense that this is what would work? Was there an element of luck? Is it serendipity? What was going on here?
It's a little bit of serendipity, but I think it also speaks directly to Miles Davis as a band leader and as a visionary. Like, obviously, back in those days, you couldn't just hop online and see who was playing what. He had to go by word of mouth, and people were telling him, no, you need Ron Carter on bass. Oh, you want a pianist? You need to get Herbie Hancock. If you need a drummer, you need to get Tony Williams. And so he put this band together just wanting a newer, fresher sound because he was a little older. He wanted younger cats in the band who could push his sound towards something else.
And this is Paris in the early 60s. Why was Paris, France, so important in Miles Davis's life?
Because Miles Davis, just like other black men at that time, they felt at home when they went to Paris. Because if you think about it, if you're Miles Davis, you went to Juilliard, you're widely recognized as perhaps the greatest jazz musician in the world. But still, when you go home, home being the United States, you're still treated like a second-class citizen. And so Europe and Paris in particular became a panacea for people like Miles Davis and others because they weren't seen as just another black man and therefore talked down to. They were seen as just people. You know, they weren't seen as colors. And so that's why it was so important. And I feel like that's why the music resonates so much, is because there's something to be said about creative freedom. And there's something to be said about your body feeling better when you're in a place where you feel welcomed. And that's exactly what it was when Miles Davis was in Paris, because he was in a place where people saw him, they would pay to come to the show, and he's playing in these grand halls. Whereas in New York, he may be playing in like a basement jazz club or something like that. So it just, the environment spoke to the music, and in turn, the music sounds fresher and more alive.
And France remained important to him and a big market for him throughout his life, didn't it? I mean, am I right in saying he played in France really not that long before he died?
Yeah, no, that's correct. No, France was definitely a place that he would go back to over and over. And obviously, France is it's a romantic place, you know. So when you're living in a place like New York, we love New York, but also it can be hard living. When you go somewhere else and you're seen and you feel more relaxed, there's something to be said about that, and I can totally understand why he would keep going back and forth.
The one and only Miles Davis. I was talking to the music journalist Marcus J. Moore, and that is The World Tonight. I'm Jane Hill. From me and everybody on the team here, a very good night.